And coming up, here's Gene Shepherd.
Kitchen sink. Lots of fun, unusual gift. We supply equipment, instructions, a liberal amount of sand, I'll bet, containing gold. You supply a little water, you can pan gold in your kitchen sink. Oh my God, where will it ever end? Bring it up, please, would you, Herb? Thank you. By the way, this is kind of a new year yet, it'll be new. I'd say that the year will be new to most of us till, would you guess, about the middle of July, roughly? And you will accept 1973 as an official year. That's right. And you'll actually start writing it on checks and stuff like that. You know, I'll tell you, so the craziest thing, so the other day, you know, this whole business of time really makes guys' mind turn to cottage cheese. Like the other day, a guy gave me a check, see? And I just deposit it in the bank, you know, just like with a couple other checks. And a couple of days later, I get a call from the bank, and I said, hey, there's something funny with this check. And I said, what? I said, well, we'll send it. You can take a look at it. And the check comes back to me. You know, that I had deposited. So I was like, oh, that guy's check. And it said on a check, December 2nd, 1956. And I said, what the hell? December 2nd, 1956? And they had circled it, you know. So I called the guy up. And I said, hey, you wrote December 2nd, 1956 on a check here. And while I have nothing against that year or that day, particularly, it's a kind of an unusual thing to write on a check that you just gave me, you know, like a couple of months ago. And he said, doggone it. You know, that kind of, doggone it. And I said, what's the matter, Harold? He says, doggone it. Did I do that again? I said, well, I guess you did do it again. I said, why, do you do this often? He said, well, it isn't always 1956. Sometimes it's 1958 I write on checks. I said, what made this guy's inner clock, whatever it is, you know, the inner clock we have, what made him stop in 1956? I mean, I wonder what happened, you know, if you take the average guy who's sound asleep, see, and he's laying there, and his mind is way out in Lower Slavovia or Upper Tibet or someplace, you know, and he's lying there and he's asleep, and you shake him real hard. You say, hey, quick, what year is it? What time? What year is it? 1961. And I'm just curious, where your mind stops like that. But, it's all part of the confusion of the day. There's a confusion that's always rampant, but it's even more rampant today due to the multiplicity of media and the multiplicity of event the compiling systems. I like that. You see, it's all part of the new Shepherd, you know, where you use, really really deep, penetrating phrases, the multiplicity of event compiling media. You realize what an event compiling media is? Well, that's your wristwatch. It compiles the number of hours that have transpired since, there's all kinds of trick words you can work out that make you sound very intelligent. That's not easy with many of us. You know, fakery is part of the game of life. You know, speaking of games, here recently we did a little thing on, the significance of games. That games often tell about the tenor of the times far more than the real things that people do. In fact, there's a well-developed theory along that one of the reasons why football is so fantastically popular in our day and age is because this is a violent day. And football is only part of the violence of our time. And this is, this can be paralleled with other times when fantastically violent games were popular during violent periods. For example, feeding the Christians to the lions in the Colosseum. That was a pretty exciting afternoon. And if you went out there and got a program, you know, we're cheering the lions or the Christians, depending on, you know, whether you're an animal cuckoo or not. I suspect most of the animal cuckoos would have been cheering the lions, you know. But nevertheless, the fact is that that was a pretty violent time. I mean, the Romans were pretty good at clobbering heads in many different directions in their day. So violent sports tend to follow violent times. And, have you noticed that the only time we everybody's really hip on chess is when we have a chess player that don't act like a chess player. You know, he psychs his opponent out and he blows his nose loudly whenever the guy's about to make a move. as soon as it looks like he's getting trapped, he says, I quit, take the TV cameras out, that's not, you know. In other words, it's all flim-flammery. That's what gets the people, not the game of chess. But that reminds me, you know, a couple of months back when Bobby won this world title, there was a fantastic upsurge of interest in buying chess sets. I wonder how many chess sets have lain unused after the first flurry of excitement. You know, yeah, it's packed down there with all the unfinished amplifier kits, which were purchased from Heath at one time, and all the unfinished model airplanes that never got finished. You know, you finished the half of the body. And there it is, you know, the plans. And the other half is still pinned to the board. And it's down in the basement there, or in the closet. Hey, that reminds me, speaking of the basement, tonight's subject is the basement, if you don't mind. I'll give you a warning. Hey, there's a note up there. It says we have a commercial for Beechnut. What is this, Beechnut chewing tobacco, is it? Would that be great if we did have one? You know, it opens up. Give you a little echo chamber. I can just see doing a great commercial for Beechnut chewing tobacco, you know. It starts like this. Yes, the most accurate man in your crowd chews Beechnut. Watch for Beechnut at the sound of Pitooey. Thank you. Let's hit the real Beechnut spot, Herb.
This is Fred walking into his favorite drugstore.
Hi, Fred.
Hello, Steve.
How's everything going?
Pretty good.
54 years ago, Fred's grandfather bought him his first roll of Lifesavers.
Take out for two, Steve.
And now he's doing the same.
Nostalgia over Lifesavers.
Third, his grandson.
Here you are, Freddy. Peppermint.
Gee, thanks, Grandpa.
Grandsons are why grandfathers should always buy plenty of Lifesavers.
Lifesavers, a part of living. Cause their great flavor has been around for years and years. And folks have found there's nothing quite like Lifesavers, a part of.
Lifesavers is a registered trademark.
Yeah, yeah. You can't go around indiscriminately hollering Lifesaver. You know, you get on that all that patent stuff. Yes, sir. Beechnut, it says. Is that what that was? That's very nice. Nostalgia is creeping in everywhere. 87 years ago, Clarence bought his first fly swatter, and now he's buying a fly swatter for his grand... We have a note here. Somebody says, Shepard, you're right about games. He said, have you seen the newest fantastic games? Bamberger's has a collection of them. Here's a game, for example, you can play today called Beat Detroit. It says if you travel 50,000 miles on $7,000 before your car falls apart, you've beat Detroit. Each player begins in the car dealership with a new car. You know, when you start out, you each get a new car. $7,000 in the funny money and a warranty. But as it is in real life, the odds are well stacked against anyone beating the system. With a lot of luck and a minimum of skill, you can prevent yourself from being the victim of many obstacles that await you on your trip. See, the important thing is a minimum of skill. Very few people want to play a game that requires a maximum of skill and a minimum of luck. That would show up too many real... You know, that's true. A lot of people gave up playing Scrabble because they discovered they were dumb. Oh, wow. You know, they did. And not much luck in winning a game of that. And for that reason, a lot of people have permanently given up. And now they're playing this game, this great new game from Bamberger's called Lie, Cheat, and Steal. And, yeah, that's the name of the game. It says, in this tongue-in-cheek political game, it is possible to win by playing scrupulously honest or by cheating shamelessly. You win by accumulating money and buying votes. Whether you take just that which is due to you or perhaps cheat a little is entirely up to you. But don't get caught or you're likely to spend some time in jail. Well, of course, that deviates from real life right there. I mean, very few politicians that are cheating on the, you know, buying votes. I never heard of a, you know, guy. But nevertheless, that's a typical game of our time. No, I'm not inventing lie, cheat, and steal. Or how would you like to play Airport? Airport. It says, run your own airline with a unique game about one of today's largest industries. Workers go on strike. Flights are grounded by bad weather. A computer breakdown causes reservation mix-up. And a hijacker forces a Florida-bound flight to make an unscheduled stop in Cuba. An intriguing game of the actual intricacies involved in the operation of an airline. First one that makes $1 million wins. Yes, sir. It's all a spin-off, you know, real life. By the way, if you're it's a spin-off, sure. For those of you who are fans of slob art, you can now buy a talking toilet. It says a wireless party idea of the year. When a guest sits on your, quote, John seat, a laughing voice says, ho, 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 hey, I'm down here, ho, 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 woo! And then they jump up and run out and get all excited, apparently. That's what it says. You can also buy an exploding John now. Did you know that? You load it up with little caps, you know, like caps on the cap gun, you know? And when the John is used, there's a loud explosion, causing excitement and confusion and merriment among the observers. And that's all. Where will it ever end? Well, that's the point. It won't. Yeah, that's right. It's called Exploding John Seat. Makes them jump. Loaded with paper caps. Slightest pressure sets it off and can be used anywhere. Comes with a complete imitation leopard skin carrying case. So you can carry it around, you know, and load up your friends, John. It's only $1.95. Yes, sir. You can buy chest hair now, which is number 2172 in the Johnson & Smith catalog. If nature forgot you, simply press on this chest piece. Chest piece for $1. Chest, it goes right on you, you know. You got a bald chest. It's just a hunting crossbow. 80 pounds of force. Easy for beginners and silent. You know what a hunting crossbow is. You know what that's all Johnson & Smith. Big ear, electronic sound collector, 18-inch parabolic ear, works on 1-volt transistor battery, a 1-transistor battery on a 40-inch tripod. Set it up and listen to everybody in the neighborhood there. Have all kinds of stuff. Yeah, and you've got a blow-up rubber chicken, too. This is WOR, speaking of rubber chickens, WOR in New York. And we have another little goodie to lay on you. And it's a goody-goody. It's a goody-goody-longy-goody. Hit it there.
Unforgettable.
Are you a Nat King Cole fan?
Then listen to this great money-saving offer. The Longines Symphonette Society has just put together a beautiful seven-record treasury with 70 of Nat King Cole's most unforgettable recordings. All of his great hits are here. Tenderly.
Caress the trees. Tenderly.
Ramblin' Roads.
Ramblin' Roads.
I Remember You. And, of course, Sweet Lorraine.
Now I just found joy.
Hit after hit by the incomparable Nat King Cole. And here's one I'm sure is a favorite.
Roll out, go, lazy, hazy, crazy.
And this great Nat Cole classic.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, men have named you.
You'll also get Stardust. At Last. And his wonderfully touching Christmas song.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Now, thousands have already sent for this collection at $14.95. But if you act right now, you'll get all seven records, 70 Nat King Cole hits for just $9.95. Also available on 5 8-track tapes for just $16.95. And they're sold on a complete money-back guarantee from the Longines Symphonette Society. Act right now.
Call Murray Hill 72552. That's MU72552. Or write to Nat King Cole, Box 16, Grand Central Station, New York City. That's Nat King Cole, Box 16, Grand Central Station, New York City, zip 117. When the postman delivers your records, pay him $9.95 plus COD charges, or $16.95 plus COD charges for tapes. That number again is MU72552.
MU72552. Yes, the best of Kay Kaiser. Retrospective album. When will all that stop? Nostalgia stuff. It just never seems to stop. Can't you imagine the complete works of Sammy Kay? Well, you can. I'm sorry. I can. I mean, I could picture anything. It's just, I wonder whether or not the devil is behind all this. There's a theory. That's right, the demonology, the devil theory is very prevalent these days. And the devil works in mysterious ways, as we all know. And if the devil were to come, and insert in your brain an idea that you'd like to buy, 400 volumes featuring the best of Tommy Tucker's band, with an additional extra bonus volume of, the best of Blue Baron. And if the devil inserted that in your head, you realize... What's the matter? Are you thinking about that? Well, you could realize that that means that the civilization that we as we know it is slowly crumbling, to the point now where it's hard to tell the real from the true, and the true from the real, and the unreal from the unreal, and all the way down the line. But if the devil had done that to you. I mean, how would you know it? You wouldn't know it. See, the devil doesn't come and talk in your ear and say, "Hey, this is the devil. Hey, this is the devil. How would you like to have a retrospective Blue Baron album, huh? That's what you need. With the Don Brown and the three two-timers singing Roll Out the Barrel. That's a fantastic collector's item." Well, the devil does speak in many different tongues. And the most subtle of all the tongues is the one... That speaks to you, and of course in a forked tongue, I must say, that speaks to you of various wants that you think you have. You're walking down the street, and suddenly the devil says, "Hey, how would you like to have a hand-painted turtle? A hand-painted turtle with a skyline of Manhattan with the signature of John Lindsay on it." Well... You don't know the devil is saying that to you. All of a sudden, you're walking past and you get this terrible desire to own a hand-painted turtle. And now, don't laugh. Don't laugh. Did I ever tell you about the turtle painter I met? I actually talked to and met and discussed the turtle painter. you know, discussed his frustrations with his chosen career. That right? Yes? Well, of course you can't really say a man chooses his career, especially if it's painting turtles. I think it's a call that comes to you. You know, it's a great calling. I'm sure that that Picasso did not choose his career. His career chose him, right? I mean, you know, it's a call. It's a call. And most of us have a call of one kind or another in our lives. And it may be a measly call. You know, the call says, you are going to be the best Neatswood oil salesman in Bergen County. And you go out and start peddling Neatswood oil, and you have a fantastic talent for it. Due to the fact you have a call, you're motivated beyond just a guy that gets a job through a want ad. And yes, you want to have the entire neighborhood soaked in Neatswood oil before you're through. That will be your final monument. You know what is it, Neatswood oil? You don't. Well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect your life much one way or the other. No. We sportsmen know what Neatswood oil is. But you hothouse flowers wouldn't understand that. No. That's right. That's just true. You see, that's what I mean about the separation, again, the dissemination of material. That our lives are so splintered today that I mentioned Neatswood oil, 500 guys jump up and say, oh, my God, Neatswood oil, great, yeah. I wish I had some. You know, my fielder's mitt is getting out of condition. And the other 12,000 say, Neatswood oil, he made that up. Isn't that a funny name? So there you go. You know, and I don't resent it, the splinterization of our world. It must have always been that way, one way or another. And it's getting, you know, we're just getting more naturally attuned to it. But nevertheless, the devil speaks in many ways. And it speaks in many tongues. And as I said, that when you were walking around and looking at the world, you don't know whether the devil is motivating you to do that. Now, how many guys have gone out and bought another car when they got a great car? See, the car, it's working great. They've had it like, you know, for 3 or 4 years, the car is great. They're getting 28 miles to the gallon, haven't burned any oil, you know, since 1969. And, and that's running on the original set of plugs. And what makes them go out and get another one? Which has the new silly putty transmission in it, comes with the new balsa wood frame, and within 3 days he knows that it's been, you know, it's a total fiasco. Why? But what made him buy it? You think advertising did it? Advertising's been around for a long time. No. Could it be? It's the devil. That's right. Comes, hey. Look at that new wraparound windshield. Maybe it's the devil. I think it's... You know, the devil is what causes the discontent in people's lives. You know, the devil keeps saying, hey, listen, you know, you settled for that chick. My God, you have no idea what you're missing. You ought to see that. You know the fat one down there in the steno pool? That's the one. Wow. And, of course, the devil is telling you these things, but he never comes right out and sits there and has coffee with you, you know, and asks you to sign a charter or, you know, stick a pin in your finger and sign it in blood. That's all metaphysical, you know. That's all abstract. So, you know, I was the first truly frustrated artist that I've ever known. I mean, truly, and he was really frustrated, was... You know, there's a myth about the frustrated artist. I've known a lot of artists in my time, and not many of them are frustrated. A lot of them are mad at their agent, and a lot of them are bugged at the gallery, or they're TO'd. You know, they're really bugged. They're really ticked off, you know, because of their publisher, that kind of stuff. But the frustrated, not too often. But I did meet a real frustrated artist. Do you know this place up here on Broadway where they sell the fake headlines, you know, caught in panty raid, you know, that kind of real... I didn't think they even used phrase, but there, I saw a headline the other day, right in Broadway. It's supposed to be a very hip place, you know. It says, you just fill in your name. It says, Charlie Grumbach, caught in panty raid in Manhattan, and that kind of stuff. You've seen those headlines. Well, that same place, you know, they have in there, they have slot machines, they have these all kinds of games where you test your love power. You've seen those. You grab the handles, you put in a quarter or something. It used to be a nickel, now it's a quarter, see? Test your love power. And you grab these handles, and it goes up to the top, or it says nothing, forget it. Become a Franciscan monk. You know, that kind of stuff. And so up and down the line, you know. You've been in this place. Well, they used to have a guy. Where he is, I don't know now. But I don't know. That's something bad in my head tonight. So it's probably the devil speaking through me again. But, let's see. We've done... before we go any further, I'm taking the side of the devil here tonight. And I'd like to recommend that if you're going to come into town and you'd like to have some Chinese food cooked in the inimitable, inscrutable, sinister style of the Chinese, it is. This is the kind of stuff that Fu Manchu would have really flipped over. Really great. In fact, he used to eat here years ago when he was taking his undergraduate work at Columbia. He did, you know. Dr. Fu Manchu studied at Columbia for a while. He studied fungiology. Did you know that? Yeah, he's a fungiologist. Fungi, man. And he was the first guy that worked out a fantastic spore. He had a lot of cross-pollinization went into that. And he created out of a very rare spore a strain of man-eating fungi. Fungus. A fungus is one. Fungi or fungi is, the plural. Yes, that's right. It sounds like a bad Italian word. But nevertheless, he created these man-eating funguses, fungi. And he did this as his PhD thesis, by the way. And while he was studying at Columbia, he used to eat at the House of Chan a lot. It's at 52nd Street, 7th Avenue. And you just come in there and ask for the food special. It's fantastic. Make your nose sweat. And it's on the corner of 52nd and 7th Avenues right here in town. And they're open 7 days a week. It's a great restaurant. They have a nice little barzy there. You can come in and have a drinky poo. And, by the way, this is the devil speaking to you now. They have a little drinky poo. And they have a special cocktail hour there when you come in and have Chinese hors d'oeuvres. Isn't that hors d'oeuvre a French word? That's correct. Chinese hors d'oeuvre is a very strange thing. You know, sweet and sour crepe Suzettes and various things like that. But you'll like it. It's a sinister place. It's the House of Chan, 52nd Street at 7th Avenue. But to return to the wandering narrative here, I was going up. I just come to New York, see? This is one of the first things that opened my eyes, that if you're a famous man, your work does not necessarily make you famous, although your work may be famous. This is a tragic truth. It is. It's a tragic truth that many guys who have created great masterpieces are not known to the public at large. For example, how many of you know the name of the man who actually designed the famous Model A Ford? Great classic creation. But there was one guy that did it. That's right. See, there you go. That's an example of what I mean. And this is the kind of thing that makes a guy go to his grave bitter. Very bitter. Well, yes, indeed. Because some guy, designed some little dinky thing, gets on the Johnny Carson show, it's a little horn that goes, oh, oh, oh! Within 5 minutes, the guy's famous, everybody's cheering him, and they're making a movie of his life. But other guys, unsung, heroic, usually very stoical people, solid and brave. And one day, I just in New York, see, my neighborhood, by the way, was Times Square. I lived in Times Square. I lived in this flea bag over on 49th Street. And it was actually called that. Oh, they used the French phrase for flea and the French phrase for boggy. It was a flea bag. That's what it translated into as French. And it was over on 49th Street, now since defunct and unloved, unwept. Everybody's glad it's gone. The rats, used to live down. The entire first floor was occupied by the rats. The second floor of the hotel was entirely occupied by bed bugs and cockroaches. They'd given it up. And they moved the people higher and higher, see? And till finally, I was way up on the 14th floor, And I've discovered that cockroaches don't breathe well above the 14th floor. At least if they have a choice, they don't go that high. But there was a rare form of caterpillar that did make it up to that place. And my walls were covered with caterpillars in the summertime. Yeah, and little green things. Bite like hell, too, I might add. And they loved it up there. So they finally knocked that hotel down. I just see what happened when that thing fell into a cloud of dust and all the rats and the cockroaches and everything took off. But nevertheless, I was living in Times Square, so I got to know Times Square intimately. And, you know, the midnight cowboy scene is a scene that I knew very well. And so one night I'm walking along Broadway. It's a neighborhood, you know. And I'm walking along Broadway up around the late 40s there, around 48th, something like that. And this is that place, you know, where they have the fake headlines in the window. And you can go in and get all that stuff done. You can get the Lord's Prayer made on a penny in a machine. You've been in that place, Bill? Have you seen that place up there where all that stuff is? Well, right in the window, they had a tank at that time. And the tank, big tank, see, and it was full of sort of greenish water and rocks. And the tank was about, well, it wasn't full. It was about three-quarters filled, and the big rocks and stuff in there. And it looked like an aquarium, but it really wasn't because it didn't have any fish in it. What it had in it was turtles. It had about, maybe 200 or 300 turtles. They were all about the size of a quarter. You know those little turtles? And they were fantastic turtles. They were all painted. Now, for example, you could get a view of Broadway looking south and on the back of the turtle. And then there was another turtle swimming next to him, a view of Broadway looking north. You could get a picture of the Empire State Building in full color. These are all beautiful colors on the back of the turtles. And on each turtle, in little gold leaf, it said, Souvenir of Fun City, New York. And, it was kind of nice. There were all these turtles walking around in there. So I couldn't help but be impressed. Because also in those days, since I was living in this flea bag and had roughly, 8-9 cents a week to spend on light things like entertainment, I found my entertainment where I could find it, usually free, looking in the window at something, see? So I'm looking in the window watching these turtles swim around in there, and I notice in back of the turtle stand there where the turtle aquarium was, there was a desk back there and a guy wearing a smock and a beret. And he had a little Van Dyke, a little goatee. And he had a quaunted look around the eye. And I'm just actually telling you the truth, really the truth. I'm not inventing this. So I used to spend a lot of time in that place. I'd like to watch the marks come in there and test their love power on the love power machine. You know, you put a dime in there and you grab the handles. And I'd watch these guys grabbing the handles. You know, they're with this fantastic bimbo, you know, a real great looking chick. Looked like one of the Goodyear blimps, you know, with feet. You know, oh, wow. And some little guy says, watch me. He grabs the handles and it doesn't even go up. It doesn't register at all. And then the chick laughs. And, this is the kind of entertainment you go for. Like a sailor's coming in and buying taffy apples, not jazz. So, I'm walking around in this place, and I'm watching this guy over there wearing the green smock and the beret, and he's right next to the turtle tank, and nothing's doing. He's just sitting there by his little desk and just watching the scene. He had high cheekbones, kind of a sad look in the eye, a man of undetermined age, but a sort of harassed air about him. And then I see a couple of people come up, and they're talking turkey. They walk up to him, and I see there's a transaction going on. And he gets up, and he has a little net. And, you know, these little nets you use in aquariums with a little tea-strainer-type net on the end. And he starts fishing around in the aquarium, and he pulls out a turtle. And he takes the turtle, and the turtle is fighting away in this little thing, and he puts it down on the desk and starts to run across the desk, and he grabs the turtle. And he shows it to the people. They're looking at him. I see they're nodding their head. No, 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 no. So he takes the turtle, puts it back in the little aquarium. And again goes the net out. And he's looking for another one. Well, he goes through about 9 turtles. And each time these people would say, and they look in the tank again. And finally, after a long discussion, he goes over to another tank, which was behind the desk and down low. And apparently this contained, virgin turtles. He reaches down. He whips out a turtle, and this is an unpainted turtle.
principally takes the title. Now, get this, Fritz. I am witnessing this thing with great interest now. And after all, you know, when you're living in Times Square, as I say, you not only get used to any conceivable sight that the human eye has ever seen, you get jaded. I've seen every kind of scene that you could possibly imagine just living in Times Square. And I was always around at night. I was never there in the daytime. That's when I slept. And during the night, that was the only time they turned the heat on, see, in this hotel. It was always so damn cold at night that I'd spend my time walking in and out of H&H down there. So it would keep warm. So, nevertheless, you get so that you're used to every conceivable sight. But this one really stuck with me. Cause somehow, because it had all the drama, it had all the tragedy of defeat and the exhilaration and ecstasy of the human creative spirit was all in this story. And he reaches down, he takes out this little green turtle, it was about the size of a half dollar, and he had a little clamp that he put him in. What held his feet steady, just like little, no, it didn't hurt him or anything, it was just like a little plastic thing that held his feet, just clunk like that, see? And he takes out his palette. He had a palette, just like a real palette, you know, like you see pictures of guys with the thumb hole and all that, see? He takes the palette out, and he's got this brush, and he begins to paint the turtle. Well, I walk over there, see, I like to see an artist at work, and he's painting the turtle. He's working away there, and he's looking up at this chick, see, this woman who has been complaining about all the turtles with the pictures of the Statue of Liberty on the back and the panoramic view of the skyline of New York taken from the Jersey side. And he's working away there, and I see what he's doing. He's doing a portrait, a miniature portrait of this lady on the back of a turtle. Yeah, this is a kind of a nice touch. So he finished the portrait, did knocked it off in about 10 minutes. It was a real good job, see? And he takes this little brush. He's got a little tiny camel's hair brush, and he says, "Souvenir of Fun City, New York," on it. And with that, he takes a spray can, and he sprays the back of the turtle. See, apparently that makes it waterproof. So he unhooks the turtle. The turtle starts running around on the desk now, and he's got a picture of this lady on the back now. It was a fair likeness, as a matter of fact. I mean, as good as you're going to find on the average turtle. And he runs across the desk, and he picks it up, and he's going to test to see whether the turtle, you know, is a working turtle. So he picks him up, and he drops him in the tank. He swims around like hell, you know, among all the other turtles. And then I see them making their financial arrangements. They pay the artist. And he puts the turtle in a little box with some it looked like sawdust or something in there, some little weeds and stuff. And out they go with their turtle. Now, I don't know whether that turtle is still walking around, although they say that turtles grow to enormous ages. Is that correct, Bill? So it's very possible this guy's work could last maybe 100 years or more. And what's more, it's ambulatory, which is more than you can say for, say, a Jackson Pollock. Not many Jackson Pollocks walk around and procreate. although I don't imagine the painting is hereditary. I don't imagine they produce other pictures, say, on the back when they, you know, when a painted turtle makes the scene with another painted turtle. What do they get? A montage? But, that was terrible. So, nevertheless, this turtle is walking around. And I'm fascinated by this, see. They go out. So there I am, you know, I stand around, and he sees me, and he thinks I'm a live one. See, because I'm standing there watching with a great deal of interest, because, you know, I do line drawings and stuff myself. I like to meet a fellow artist, so I said, it's a very nice technique there. He says, I see you use the wet brush technique. Ah, yes, oui, monsieur. And I said, very good, that was a nice likeness, as a matter of fact. Ah, says, merci. And I could see right away he's a phony Frenchman. He's about as, much Frenchman as much as I am, see. And finally I said to him, I says, look, I said, you don't have to keep up with the French accent. I'm a native here. I'm one of the walking around deadbeats here in Times Square. So you don't have to pull the act on me with the French accent. But one thing I must say, you really did paint that painting on the back of the turtle there. He says, yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. Well, I could sense this, when you're with somebody, you've been to many times in a bar or someplace when you sense this,
the soul in torment, right? You've sensed that. And I said, well, what's the matter? And I said, yeah, it's a great turtle. Not everybody can paint the back of a turtle like that. And just like that, I hit him. You know, you hit guys, you hit a nerve ending. I hit this sore tooth like that. And he says, you're damn right. Not everybody can do that. You're damn right. Just making conversation, you know. Well, you're right. What do you mean making conversation? You're right. You're telling the truth. And not everybody can paint a turtle like that. Best damn turtle painter in the country. Well, yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, you're on Broadway. You know, I'm sure that you must have worked your way up, you know, started in a place like Olathe, Kansas, and worked your way up to Broadway. Not every turtle painter makes the big time like this. And he looked up at me. He says, are you putting me on? I says, no, I'm not. I'm not putting you on. So we stood there for about 5 seconds with this kind of tension between us. And I finally said it. You know, I said, you know, I must say this. Those are the greatest paintings I've ever seen on the back of a turtle. They're really good. And they were. They were really good. You know, if you can paint a view of Broadway looking south on a turtle the size of maybe a quarter, that's no easy trick. No way, see? And he says, oh, them! You're talking about them. Nothing. That's for the damn tourist trade. I said, what do you mean, the tourist trade? You want to see some turtles? With that, he reaches down and he pulls a tank out from under his desk. He says, now these are turtles! And they were fantastic. I mean, I want to tell you, expressionistic. The one thing I would have to say about his turtle painting technique is that he used the entire oeuvre of the turtle in his real work. This was, every artist, by the way, knows his real work from the work that they buy. They buy. That's why many artists, when they get more and more successful, they renounce their previous work. Because that's, you know, that's the junk that they had to do to sell. And he says, look at this. And he reached down, he takes this turtle, and this turtle is standing there in the middle of the table there on the green felt. And it was, have you ever seen a turtle? It was a moving turtle. I mean, a moving experience. You've read many art critics that talk about a painting that is a moving experience. His use of the modular grays. And the subtle statement that was made, and yet a statement that was highly ambiguous in its total content. Here was this turtle, and I said, that's just great. She's damn right, it's great. You're looking at my latest work and my best work. You don't see none of my turtles in the Museum of Modern Art. I said, by God, come to think of it, I haven't seen any of your turtles in the Museum of Modern Art. And, of course, this was during the heyday of, you know, all these guys that came out with the inflatable hamburgers and the guys that were making the plastic gophers and, you know, remember the big Campbell soup stuff? He says, these guys are working. Look at it. Look at all this pop art. This junk. So one day, the Museum of Modern Art is going to see my work, and I'm going to be right there. Well, what could I say to him, you know? I walked out on Broadway. And as far as I know, he never made it. I have never heard of a show at the Museum of Modern Art of fantastic, expressionistic turtles that make a statement about the world we live in. And what's more, a vital ecological statement. This is living art, truly living art. And a couple of years later, his little case in the window disappeared, and I've never seen him again. He's never been there again. And so this is all the tragic undertone to the great town and all the lights on Broadway. And I've never forgotten that turtle painter, you know? He says, by God, you know, he could have... Seriously, who's going to say no? Who's going to say no? But his turtles are somewhere living. 100 years they live. And maybe 75, 80 years from now, out of the weeds someplace, this fantastic turtle will crawl out with one of the great unsung works of the modern artist. And somebody will discover it. And he didn't even sign his work. Which is, by the way, the the key hallmark of true genius. Never cite his work. His work is more important than he is. I mean, you'd recognize one of his works instantly. You don't have to sign. You don't think for a minute that the Botticelli had to write the Fred Botticelli on the bottom of every magnificent gold salt shaker he made. Oh, no. And Da Vinci didn't write Da Vinci all over those nymphs and dryads and the angels and all that stuff on a ceiling there. No way. Michelangelo? Nah. His work stands for itself. Somewhere, probably hiding in a drain someplace, is a magnificent work of unparalleled 20th century art. Yeah. This is WOR New York. You don't listen. Stay tuned for Lester Smith and the news.
News and detail on the hour from the WOR newsroom. An estimated $400,000 worth of...